I've sort of developed this format myself because it suits me. For about the next hour, I will find my way into a topic which is interesting me and that I think is significant to others too. And what I hope is that if you don't really follow me for any reason, you'll ask a question or interject, not too outrageously, I hope. Well, you can be outrageous if you want, but that you'll break in, because that way often you'll get more out of me, or we'll get more out of the Dhamma, if you see what I mean. So I'll try to remember periodically to stop and ask if anybody knows what I'm talking about. But if, in the meantime, you really do lose it, or just find something very interesting that you'd like to go into further, stop me. And it may be that I don't want to go there, in which respectfully I'll decline, but I may follow it up, if you see what I mean. So there's some room for interaction. Let's see how it works out. Yeah, so today the Prime Minister announced there's going to be a general election in a month. So this is a party political broadcast on behalf of the reality party. In a way, it's something that we do need to think about and have some relationship to. So I'm hoping that at least by the third of these rambles, I'll be able to relate something of the Dhamma to the question of how we make a decision about who to vote for. I'm not going to recommend any particular party. Far be it from me to make that decision. But I'm hoping that I'll be able to bend the course of the discussion in a direction that will lead us to look at how we decide who to vote for. I've set myself a challenging opening, and then I'm going to go to the completely the opposite end of the scale. Today I'll try to introduce, or rather try to discuss, a way of looking at reality as a whole, the comprehensive whole. Tomorrow I'll try and look at how that impacts upon our own spiritual life and practice. And the next day I'll try and look at how that impacts on society. So the point of departure is the principle of conditioned co-production, pratitya samuppada, which probably anybody who's at all familiar with the Buddha's teaching will know about. The Buddha taught that the defining feature of everything that can be experienced, everything that can be known, is that it arises in dependence on conditions. This is well-known territory. Some accounts of the Buddha's own enlightenment present his realization precisely in these terms. The Buddha saw at the moment of enlightenment, according to some accounts, that all phenomena, everything that can be experienced, everything that does experiencing, both the subjective and objective aspects of experience, all of them arise in dependence on conditions. Of course, that then means that they themselves provide the conditions for future arisings. So that reality as a whole is nothing but a flow of conditioned arising. This is absolutely basic Buddhism. It's the primary teaching of Buddhism, accepted by all schools of Buddhism, however they may explain that or expand upon it. So everything in this situation here exemplifies that. Anything that we pay attention to can be seen as dependently arising. This situation, we're all gathered together here, arises from a whole mass of conditions. I know some of those conditions. Some of them involve the M1 and a small Vauxhall car that brought me and Dhammashal in here. you've each of you been involved with a whole mass of conditions that have rolled into you being here. And, well, actually, it goes even further back than that. My mother had something to do with it. Actually, my father too, truth be told. Well, you know, even find yourself way back at the Big Bang, whatever that was. Everything unrolls from a set of conditions. This whole situation is a bringing together of a mass of conditions that's spread out throughout history, back into beginningless time, as the Buddhist tradition says. There's no discernible beginning to that process, because wherever you get to as a beginning, there's something before it. You see what I mean? Yes, everything arises in dependence on conditions. But simply to say that one thing arises in dependence upon conditions is to imply a certain regularity to things. The Buddha said that everything is niyamata. Niyamata means ordered, happens in an orderly way, is regular. Well, regular, of course, comes from a Latin word meaning rule or even law. Law in the scientific, not the the legal sense. So everything arises in a regular way. It's not random. It's, of course, extremely important for us as human beings. If things were random, we couldn't really make any decisions, because when we act in one way one time, we can't rely upon that conforming to what happened on previous occasions. But reality is ordered. Niyamata is a very significant term in Buddhism. So conditioned arising isn't simply a question of saying that this arises in dependence on that. It's a question of saying that this arises in dependence on that in an ordered way, according to patterns that are, well, structured into reality. Reality is ordered. So clearly the discernment of that order is very significant for our lives. If we can understand that order, we can act in accordance with it. We can order our lives in accordance with those regularities to our own benefit. The Buddhist teaching goes further than that. It says that those regularities are not merely to do with material phenomena, with physical phenomena. They're to do with our minds. They're to do with our direct experience. Our experience arises in an orderly way. It obeys regularities that are built into the nature of things. So, this will all become a bit clearer, but you've got the general picture. Everything's conditioned. Everything arises in dependence on conditions. Those conditions, those conditioned arisings, obey certain regularities, laws that are structured into things. Why? I was going to say God knows, but of course he's not among the conditions, or rather he's only among the mental conditions, because from a Buddhist point of view he's man created, human created. So the regularities are built into the structure of things. You could say that even the why question is in principle not answerable, because it implies a point of view outside reality, which, well, you can't take, because to be outside reality is to already imply an order to things that is extra real, which therefore is real, if you see what I mean. Don't worry if you didn't follow that. sophisticated philosophical argument. So reality is ordered. And the Buddha does, in various places in the Pali Canon, explore and expound that orderedness, but never in a very systematic way. He makes it clear that things can arise for different, according to different different ordered structures. For instance, feelings of happiness or unhappiness, pain or pleasure, may arise for a number of different reasons. There's a famous sutta, the Molya Sivaka Sutta, if anybody's interested, from Samyutta Nikaya, in which he talks about why pain and pleasure may arise. The first thing is he says it may be to do with wind. You know what he means. It may be to do with bile. It may be to do, and wind, of course, in the ancient Indian system was more like chi, you know, a sort of the currents of energy, deep energy within the body. It may be to do with you know, physical processes in the body. It may be to do with an accident. It may be to do with external attack. Or it may be to do with your own actions. So it's not very systematic, but he sets out a number of different ways in which pleasure and pain may arise. In different places in the suttas, he explores different aspects of regularity. In later Buddhist tradition, in one particular tradition, which has come to be very important to our own teacher's explanation of things, five different niyama, orderednesses, regularities, are distinguished. The so-called five niyamas. And it's those that I want to explore today, and which I hope will lead to us understanding who to vote for the day after tomorrow, believe it or not. There's a cliffhanger for you. You'll have to come back to find out. So I'm going to look at the five niyamas. I'm looking at them partly for their intrinsic merits, and as they've always fascinated me, partly because I've had a series of conversations with Sangharakshita recently in which he's been wanting to talk about his sort of fundamental conception of the Dhamma, and in some ways to correct positions that he's taken in the past, in some ways to take it further. The niyamas has been the principal vehicle for this. So I'm going to write up these conversations that I've had with him, and that they hopefully will be published after Sangharakshita's had a look at them in the next 2 or 3 months when I get time to do it. But in the meantime, I want to sort of preview the conversations that I've had with him, partly to get my own mind engaging with them a bit fuller, more fully. So, hot off the press, although nothing very surprising, but just sort of ways of thinking and talking that are a little bit new. So let's look at the five niyamas. Let's just write them up for a start, so you know what they are.
And five niyama. This word, which means orders, you might say, even a bit like the in taxonomy, the orders of help any biologists or anything like that. Orders of something or other. You know, where you get the something order, then this order, then that order. Never mind, it's there somewhere. So, right at the bottom, you've got, I'm going to give you the Pali because then it sounds grander, doesn't it? And then, Putu, Bija, Mano. Kamma and Dhamma. Can you see that? Is that coming out? I'm not going to write up what I mean, because it spoils the surprise. So, first of all, you've got the
Uttu Niyama. Uttu means, what can you say? It sort of really means matter, I suppose, not to put too fine a point upon it. So it's the physical inorganic order of conditionality. The order of reality that is explored in modern science by physics and inorganic chemistry. So the pattern of conditioned arising that we see in matter without any life. So you can see regularities. You can see that, well, for instance, the law of gravity would be a law under the heading of Uttu Niyama. So you can see that a heavier body attracts a lighter one to it. So that, you know, if you drop from a great height, you'll fall towards the earth. If you throw a stone up, it'll eventually fall back to earth. So it's the law, the range of laws that govern the behaviour of inorganic matter. Of course, we use this language of governs and law, which can set up the wrong sort of associations in one's mind, because governing demands a governor. So who's the governor? And a law sort of implies a police force and a judge and so forth, but it's not really like that at all. It's more a question of recognising that there are regularities that are invariable, that always a lighter body will be attracted to a heavier one, ceteris paribus, other things being equal, under normal conditions and so forth and so on. So it's a question of, it's more description, you might say, than that is implied by the terminology of law. Of course, the description is a description of what happens. So there's something about the way reality is that within a universe of this kind, a stone always falls to the ground. The physical inorganic matter, under certain conditions, forms into complex arrangements which leads to life. And bija, which literally means seed, is the organic dimension of the organic order of conditionality. It's what happens when matter becomes organised in such a way that it's, in some sense, living. I'm afraid I haven't thought enough about how one would exactly and precisely define the distinction, but it's broadly the dimension of conditionality that's governed by the, or rather that's described by the sciences of biology, botany, and so on. So you notice there's a sort of progression that the Uttu Niyama explores conditionality at the most basic level. It works itself up into organized systems that are in some sense self-replicating and self-feeding. Which are organic, living. A certain point comes when those organic arrangements, systems, gain a certain instinctual life. You might say they have a mind in the most primitive sense. They begin to display certain patterns of conditioning, which are, at least in the lowest sense, intelligent. Instinct, it's the realm of instinct, it's the realm of stimulus response, where the organism responds to its environment according to certain patterns, which can be examined, which can be discerned, so that When you show the dog a meal, it salivates and so forth, and you can breed that pattern into it. Of course, instinct can be extremely complicated. I live in Wales, and at certain times of the year, the eels come up all the tiny little rivers from the lake, from the big river, from the sea, and they go up into the mountains, into little pools in the mountains. They breed there, and then their little elvelings. Is that right word? Elvelings? No, that's something else. Sorry, excuse the Tolkien reference. I can't remember. Elvers, that's it. They go down the stream, and they go all the way out to the Sargasso streets. You can tell I'm no botanist or zoologist or anything like that. And the whole pattern repeats itself. And apparently they come up the same rivers as their mummies and daddies did. And this incredibly complex journey across the world takes place according to patterns of instinct, that it's almost impossible to believe there isn't a God who keeps it all under control, although it's beyond any God that I can think of. So this is the manonyama, these instinctual patterns that are developed in organisms that reach a certain level of sophistication. And of course, probably exactly where you could say that the bija niyama gives rise to the manonyama, very difficult to say, and you get very, very subtle movements in even single-celled organisms that have a certain regularity and a certain kind of intelligence, but which at a more sophisticated zoological level are very definitely patterns of instinct that can be extraordinarily sophisticated, but don't involve any degree of self-consciousness, or rather, if there is self-consciousness, it's of a kind that is very, very primitive indeed. So you get this gradual increase of the sophistication. You might even say of evolution, that at the lowest level there's simply inorganic matter that is interacting on the basis of laws of regularity, which under certain circumstance forms itself into organized systems that have a certain integrity, that are living, organic. Those organic systems further complexify and develop regularities that can only be described as intelligent, even if the intelligence is instinctual. At a certain point, that instinctual intelligence breeds self-consciousness. Self-consciousness emerges from that, especially associated with the use of language, with the use of symbol. So the intelligent life form is able to identify itself, able to distinguish itself from other aspects of experience, and able to sustain that identity over a period of time. At this point, a quite new kind of conditioning opens up. The kind of conditioning that we call karma. I'll come back to all of these in a moment, but I'll just flesh out the whole system. So, karma gives rise to a set of regularities that govern the relationship between the self-conscious individual and experienced effect. That's the principle of karma. So once you become aware of yourself as an individual, a relationship is set up between you and what is not you. And that relationship is governed by regularities. And the regularities are karma. Again, we're going to need to explain this much more. beyond that, something else comes into play which is much more difficult to talk about, and which in a way is the main thing I want to get at in this this discussion today. Kamma implies, yes, the self-conscious individual. But a point comes when the self-conscious individual makes contact with a pattern of conditioned arising that transcends the individual, which is a discernible regularity within reality, which you can explore through examining your own experience. You can explore through examining the psychological and religious experience, philosophical experience, cultural experience of many, many men and women over the generations, where a new kind of conditioned relationship enters into play, which the Buddha referred to as the Dhamma Niyama, and which is worked out in this later commentarial tradition in terms of the five niyamas as the last and the highest of the niyamas. So I know that's a little bit obscure, but I hope that it will become as clear as it possibly can be. In a way, it needs to, in the end, remain obscure. But I hope the obscurity will be less obscure. So there's...
You say that it can only be experienced differently from the way we experience the rest of reality.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry?
Are you saying that fifth one can only be experienced in a different way from the way we experience reality in order? We have to grow another sense or another understanding.
Of course, in a way, I need to create a bit more of a framework for talking about it, but just to take your point, it's not so much that you need a different sense to discern it. You need a great deal more sensitivity to discern it. It's a pattern that's working within you, but that you need a great deal of sensitivity to be aware of. So and again, don't forget these are regularities. It's not a something. You see what I mean? It's a process. It's a process that is, as it were, potential all the time, but that unfolds once you become, or once you begin to cooperate with it. But I hope that will get clearer. Is that enough for the time?
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. So again, it's important, I think, to present this in the context of the other niyamas, because it demonstrates the kind of what one is talking about. So that if we're talking about gravity, it's not a thing. There's no such thing as gravity, but the stone falls to the ground. There's the conditioned pattern is there, which you will discern. The flower will, or rather the plant will photosynthesize. It's not something. Photosynthesis isn't a thing. It's a description of what happens, the way in which a plant absorbs sunlight or whatever. The mano-niyama is a description of a regularity that's discerned in animals and in ourselves. The mano-niyama works in us too. So that, for instance, you hear a loud noise and you jump. It's not something you don't choose to jump. It just happens instinctively. When you're tired, your brain doesn't work properly. You can't think clearly. When you're hungry, yes, patterns of behavior are initiated in you that you in a way don't have to think about, and so on. The mano-niyama, we in we effectively participate in all five niyamas, or potentially participate in all five niyamas. The two higher ones are the ones that are most characteristic of us. So they're descriptions of regularities that we can discern in ourselves and that we can discern in the world around us. And an intelligent life is one in which you learn to recognize the regularities and to live with them rather than against them. So, for instance, there's an implication here, which I'll go into a bit more tomorrow, that you have a body. You have a body, you have a mind, you have an instinctive mind. So you need to pay attention to your body as an organism. You need to pay attention to your mind as an instinctive mind. You cannot, play with instincts beyond a certain point. If you do, they become... They backfire on you. You know, there's a whole sort of discussion in the Buddhist tradition about not playing with excessive ascetic practices, because in a way, what you're doing is playing with your instincts. You know, for instance, you can starve yourself, but all that does is under the mano niyama and its interaction with bija and utu niyama, it just weakens your body and your mind won't work properly. This is what the Buddha found. So you need to, as it were, make your peace with the lower niyamas if you want to explore and experience and take advantage of the higher niyamas. So kama niyama is where we really need to begin a little bit more explanation. I think that the lower niyamas are fairly straightforward. Is that the case? So far, so good? So kama niyama is... The set of regularities that come into play when a self-consciousness arises, when you're able to identify yourself as enduring within time and as separate from other things around you, which is, from an evolutionary point of view, a major transition point. This is, of course, where in Sangharakshita's higher evolution, lower evolution presentation of the Dhamma is where the big shift is from the lower evolution to the higher evolution. With the higher evolution, the higher evolution begins when you can identify yourself as an enduring individual within, separate from the other things around you and other people especially around you. And you can begin to see how you affect the world around you. So kama niyama is this law that the regularity that is discerned in the relationship between the self-conscious individual and experienced effect. Now that needs a bit of precising. Obviously some of the experienced effect is simply under the other laws, the other conditioned patterns. If I drop something on my toe, I'll experience pain under these niyamas, if you see what I mean. So the agency for the effect is through the other niyamas. But some of the effect of our actions is experienced internally. Kama, as you probably all know, means action. In modern North Indian languages, it's still the same. Karma comes from a verb meaning to do. So it's what is done. It's action. And action in the sense of conscious action, intentional action, where there's the intervention of something more than just physical processes, just biological processes, even just instinctive processes. There's something where there's an intervention of a self-identification. You, at some level or other, even if it's very peripherally, you might even say unconsciously, you decide to act. And that action emerging from a decision to act, as I say, however peripheral, even semi-conscious or almost unconscious, affects what comes back at you, inside you, at least that. It affects, it modifies your own experience. It modifies especially the quality of your enjoyment, you could say. Karma leads to a sense either of pain and frustration or of pleasure, fulfillment. Not, of course, one individual action, although one action can have a very, very strong determining effect on your inner satisfaction or frustration or whatever. But the sum total, the direction of your overall acting, your overall intending, modifies your inner experience. That much is quite easy to understand. That is probably relatively easy to determine. Every time you sit down, the exercise we did earlier, you're directing your attention to your contact and so far as you could, and then you're just sitting. What you're then left with is to some extent the product of your previous volitions, your previous actions. The mind that you've got now, the sort of tone of your mind now, the quality of your mind now, is generally to do with the way you've used your mind in the past. This is the easiest and the most straightforward way of understanding the kama niyama, this kind of regularity, and it's regular. Of course, it's not that every time you sit down to do the metta bhavana, you get a pleasant feeling. I know this. Because it's not just to do with one action. It's to do with the whole accumulation of effort over time and all the other things you're involved with and so on. But you can discern that the development of more and more skillful states of intention does lead to a greater and greater sense of fulfillment. And the opposite. The more complicated thing to explore, which the Buddhist tradition very definitely argues, is that in a rather mysterious way, a way that's not easy to discern, your intentions also modify what comes, what modify the world around you, and may affect what comes back at you. So that what you do, in a general way, or what you do in a very strong way, may bring back at you a proportionate response from the world around you. Now, Buddhism very, very definitely says that not everything that happens to you happens because of karma. And this is partly what this illustrates, isn't it? Because part of what's happening to you is because of the physical inorganic. Part of it's to do with the organic. If you catch a disease, a virus, it's partly, mainly, perhaps even, to do with organic matters. Maybe affected by your mental state, because it's also been shown that a positive, generally positive approach to life is health-giving, but presumably beyond a certain point, no amount of healthy attitude can mean you evade sickness. But yes, it's very definitely not the case that everything that happens to you is the result of karma. But according to tradition, some things that happen to you from outside may be, in a way that's not easy to discern, the consequence of your past actions. So I've heard this described. In fact, Sangharakshita said that he thought the best way to think about this was that karma was, in this sense, a law of attraction. that mental states and worldly situations sort of attract each other. And so that, you know, the development of very, very negative mental states will tend to attract to you very painful and negative experiences. Not always, and not everything that happens can be explained in that way. Much of it, you know, we live in a world where bricks fall on heads. The good, the bad, and the ugly. You know, if there's a plane crash and many people are killed, you can't say it's their karma, because there will be good people there, there will be bad people there, and probably mostly fairly ordinary people who are neither good nor bad. So we don't try to explain everything in that way. But sometimes you sort of feel that, in certain cases, I've once or twice experienced this myself, that there's something that sort of seems to keep happening that I can't just put down to coincidence. Or not, I can go no further than saying, perhaps that's to do with something from the past. And not even able to really say what it is. The Buddha himself said that, don't bother about it. Don't think about it. Just accept that this may happen. But don't try to piece it all out. In the Buddhist East, there is a bit of a tendency to sort of go karmic explanation hunting. I think in the West we tend to be over psychological in our approach to karma, but in the Buddhist East there's often, you know, a failure to sort of think in terms of the internal effects of karma, and more of a tendency to look for explanations from outside.
It's just occurred to me. Would you consider perhaps things that happen in meditation that sort of seem to have no other reason or rationality
Well, I would say that's fairly straightforward. Because of course there you're not dealing with the other niyamas, you're just involved with the mind sense, if you see what I mean. I think I talked last time I was here about I did a long solitary retreat, 8 months, without going out, 5 months completely alone, and you know, there's not a lot coming at you from outside. I live in Wales, so, you know, sheep really don't do much to you. They try their best, but they have limited ability to do so, only having a limited mano niyama. But what is fascinating is why certain things start coming up in your mind, and why certain patterns unfold within you. Why, you know, again, I think I remember saying, did I spend the whole day reconstructing a James Bond movie that I never enjoyed when I saw it 30 years before? The sort of images come into your mind under the law of the dynamics of the mind, part of which is to do with karma, and it just keeps on cropping up. So one of the things that you'll find if you do engage with meditation a great deal, and especially if you go on solitary retreat or an intensive retreat, is that karma starts to serve up your past to you, good, bad, and indifferent. It starts to sort of all emerge within you. Unresolved karmic impetuses begin to discharge themselves, and a lot of what you have to do is purify yourself. That's what I felt I had to do for the first few months of my retreat, just purify myself. Well, it wasn't a question of even purifying myself, it was just not making it worse again, if you see what I mean, and just sort of letting it all hang out, letting it all emerge and discharge itself. I also, but just by the way, I also got some sense that there's something coming from dimensions that I couldn't really explain within this life. I think I might have mentioned this here. And if, I know I can't prove anything of this, but I just got a very strong sense at some point that I'd killed. And the sense was that it was in war. And no images or anything like that, but just a strong sense that I killed under conditions of warfare, which is, as it were, better than not. Probably, perhaps. And I had to sort of let that up. Whether it was really like that or not, I don't know. But something in my mind, from somewhere or other, had that sort of shape to it and needed to be discharged. If you accept the theory of becoming, some life before mine had influenced mine in that way. So karma is both internal in the immediate sense of what happens in this life. You're all the time, every time you allow an image into your mind or a thought into your mind and you give it some energy of intention, it will reoccur under certain conditions. Not all of it will reoccur, but under certain conditions it's there, available to recur, with its own particular pleasant, painful flavour, because every mental event, every physical event, has a flavour of pleasure or pain attached to it. And some of that may predate even this life, according to Buddhist tradition. Some of what happens to you from outside may be to do with things you've done. According to Buddhist tradition, the fact that you're in a human life at all is to do with the kind of mind that you formed in your previous life. So you developed, as it were, an affinity with this world. Yeah.
I just wonder about the plane crash again.
Ah.
Because we got ourselves involved in this particular kind of the world,
sure.
Which is highly technological.
Yeah. Yeah.
For whatever.
Yeah.
We then decide to take this plane.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the nature of things.
Yeah.
As well. So,
yeah.
Which is possible gravity in.
Yeah,
world.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just seems like karma is very complex in terms of our interaction with our surroundings rather than I'm a bad person.
Well, the traditional analysis would be that you're it's not that you chose a world, because you don't really choose in that way, but you were attracted to the stream of, it's not really the stream of energy coming from a previous life had an affinity with this world, and in this world various things happen. And of course, you may have made choices which lead to you getting on a plane. But if you're in this world, things happen. Lightning strikes. Earthquakes happen. And those only have to do with your karma insofar as you have an affinity with a human world within which that happens. So there's quite an important distinction. I think it's very important not to use the word choice there, if you see what I mean. It's this, it happens by virtue of an affinity. It's sort of a drawing together of the stream of energy and the circumstance or situation that suits it, or that it can manifest through. Yes, so it is more complex than that, but what I was particularly wanting to get away from is what you do hear, even in Buddhist circles, which is that the plane crash happened because of the karma, the direct karma of those particular people. I came across this recently because two very good friends of mine were killed in a car crash in India, and people there were, who have of course a Hindu background, where in primitive Hinduism, actually in primitive Buddhism too, there's a tendency to ascribe everything to karma. So people were saying that these people must have done something bad for that to happen. Actually, what they did is choose to take a taxi at night on a notoriously bad road. So whether with too little information or out of impatience or whatever, they put themselves in a situation where there's a quite high likelihood of accidents. So you could say that choice is there, but it's not that the accident happens to them as a sort of a result of their unskillfulness. Things do happen, according to tradition, as a response to the quality of a state of mind, the ethical quality of a state of mind. Some things, but what they are, it's really not worth, not fruitful to say. What is generally said, that if you find a recurrent situation keeps on happening, it may be worth considering karma as a factor. But generally speaking, what happens to you from outside, you can easily explain in terms of the other niyamas. Your decisions influence it, as Jayachetta said, but you don't think of a one-for-one relationship. My unskillful mental state, a bad thing that happens to me. So, kama niyama is the law that the regularities that govern the relationship between self-conscious individual and experienced effect, the quality of the decisions in ethical terms, determining the nature of the response internally and sometimes even externally. If there weren't that regularity, basic spiritual life would not be possible. You wouldn't be able to make any sort of spiritual progress, because you wouldn't be able to make any sort of effort. One time you do the mindfulness of breathing and you get very, very concentrated, and another time you get very scattered. Yeah, I know that does happen, but you're looking at the overall momentum of it all, and not just one practice, but the overall momentum of one spiritual life. There is a build-up of greater and greater awareness and skillful volitions, and even in the end, sooner or later, of a pleasurable sense of fulfillment and innocence. But what becomes really interesting is that that's not enough. We've said that the kama niyama is to do with the relationship between the self-conscious individual and the experienced effect, particularly internally. But we know, as Buddhists, as good Buddhists, or interested in Buddhism, we know that self-consciousness is, to some extent, delusive. It seems as if there is a stable, solid, enduring identity. But actually, when we look at it, everything about us is shifting and changing. There's nothing about us that is fixed. The patterns of our volitions are constantly shifting, constantly changing. Patterns of our intelligence, of our understanding, are constantly shifting and changing. Our bodies are constantly shifting and changing. So the idea of an I is a mental convenience. Sometimes if you think about yourself when you were very small, very young, it's almost impossible to sort of connect yourself now with what you were like then. It's very hard to see what you were like then with what you are now. You know there's a continuity. You can see a continuity of memory at the very least, taking you right back. And of course there are patterns of character and so forth that are very discernible. I just had a retreat with people who I'd been associated with for 20 years or more, and some of them I hadn't seen for 8 years. What I found very, very striking is that in many ways they're all exactly the same. So there's a lot for people I've ordained. What was also interesting was that in a certain sense, they had changed. In a way, they were almost as if they were more than themselves than ever before. So there's a change in the ethical and spiritual quality by and large, but the kind of pattern of character remains the same, because it's connected to a large extent with the body. So yes, everything about us actually is changing, and kama, therefore, which emerges in relation to the self-conscious individual looking at action, has its limits. And there's a point at which another process can be discerned, a process at work even in our own experience, a process at work in very great individuals. That's the easiest way for us to see it. for Buddhists, it's most adequately exemplified in the life of the Buddha. So there's a pattern of conditioning, a regularity within reality that makes Buddhahood possible. There's a pattern of conditioning that makes it possible for us to become Buddhas. It's not something made up. It's not something created. It's not something that we sort of invent. It's something that is a potential within reality. There is within reality a regularity that if we can align ourselves with it, leads on to enlightenment itself. You can discern it in other religions too. You can discern patterns of progress. From a Buddhist point of view, those patterns of progress are often limited by the conceptualizing that surrounds them. Very, very interesting. I've been reading up on modern Shiism, particularly the life of Ayatollah Khomeini. Not for inspiration, I assure you. But one of the things I found very, very interesting is that he's clearly a mystic, against the trend of the highly legalistic Shiism of Iran. He clearly had a very strong mystical inner life, and a lot of what he talked about I could recognise from a Buddhist point of view. It's put in terms that, you know, are different from the terms that I would choose to put it in, but it's easy to see what he's talking about. But it's put within the framework of an interpretation of history, the Shiite interpretation of history. It's put in within a framework of a theology, which then distorts it so that Ayatollah Khomeini was capable of ordering the death of thousands of people who disagreed with him. So you can discern that there is something definitely there. There's a sort of pattern that's unfolding, but it's put within a package that sort of puts it off skew, and then, of course, runs into problems as regards karma. So these patterns are not Buddhist. It's that, from at least in my view, Buddhism gives, perhaps, in my own exploration, it definitely gives the most clear and adequate description of that conditioned pattern within reality. And what the tradition says, or what in a way this outline says, is that just as with the law of gravity, you need to understand the law, and then you can work with it. You can make it work for you, so to speak. If you want to throw something at somebody, you can calculate the degree of push you need to give to get it there, and so on. If you're trying to jump over something, you know, you automatically calculate what you need to overcome gravity, and so on. And you can see that for all the other laws. You can work with them. With karma, ethics, the precepts, are simply defining how you work with karma. They're guidelines as to how you work with karma, so that it works to your benefit. To your benefit and the benefit of others too, of course. So that the Dhamma Nima has its own conditioned laws, which are potentially working within you. They may work within you from time to time. You may have experiences that unfold that speak of something that's trans-individual, that goes beyond you as a mere individual. You may experience some touch of something beyond you. So it's an active possibility. It's interesting, it's difficult to know exactly how to talk about it, because in a way it transcends our language, which, you know, is mainly drawn from the physical world, to some extent from the world of instinct, and to some extent from the law of ethics. But there's a pattern within life that's difficult to know how to talk about, because it goes beyond your individual experience, your experience as an individual that belongs to a state of experience, a state of consciousness that is more than just you as a self-identified individual, and that has a certain sort of force to it. The experience that one gets, all the those who begin to experience it report, is that it seems as if something works in you rather than that you do something. So the analogies that are often given are of you know, something like that. There's a famous analogy that it's as if the beginning of your spiritual life you have to sort of row yourself into the middle of the river, but then the stream carries you. So that your effort is at the level of the kama niyama. You have to self-consciously get yourself into the midst of the stream, and then the stream carries you. Of course, in classical Buddhism, you have the language of the stream entrant, who enters the stream. And the stream is the Dhamma Niyama. It's this current implicit within reality, this pattern of conditioning, this regularity, this range of possibility, that once you begin to touch upon it, works dynamically. You don't do it. It's more as if it does you. Of course, you know, we're at the, right at the limits of language, and one of the things I'm going to have to explore tomorrow is a bit more how we have to talk about this, because we need to avoid two extremes. One extreme is of reductionism, where you fail to talk about it. And a lot of Western Buddhism, I think, does this. It talks in such humanistic terms that it misses the vast majesty and the extraordinary sort of power of this other dimension of conditionality. There's another danger, which is that you talk about it so sort of familiarly, and with such a sort of concrete fixity that you think you've understood it when you haven't. Fundamentally, it's a mystery. That is probably the most important thing to think about it, and where I'm going to leave you, because time is out. But the Dhamma Niyama is essentially a principle or a level of conditionality that is implicit in reality, that unfolds dynamically, which you as an individual can cooperate with, but which you cannot command, and which in the end defies our definition. And you know, in the end, we must, in a sense, speak of as a mystery. So tomorrow, we'll poke a little bit further into the mystery and talk about how we get ourselves to the point of letting that mystery unfold within us. And I'll talk a little bit more about the, as it were, the philosophy of the Dhamma Niyama and what not to do and what we can do, if you see what I mean, in talking about it. So, time out.